From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. I am Karina.
And I am Chiara. In this second episode of Urban Resilience Dialogues, we will explore how feminist approaches to urban planning and urban development can contribute to urban resilience. Obviously, we need to start by saying these are huge topics in their own right, so we won't cover it all. But we felt it's such a key overlap to explore. From the disproportionate impact that climate change is having on women and girls, the ways in which sexism is encoded in our cities, to inspiring stories and alternatives to this too. One of which we've just heard in the intro, the feminist anthem that's gone viral, El Violador Eres Tú. So cities are also major places of activism. It is where we march. How not thinking of the Women's March that started in the US in 2017 before spreading in many cities around the globe.
And we are delighted to say that today we're joined by Jenna Dutton, an inspiring urban planner, community leader, and activist. Her background is in urban planning, anthropology, and community development. Jenna has worked in collaboration with and for local governments as well as private sector entities for over 10 years and has demonstrated expertise in development and policy planning, strategic planning, project management and public engagement. She is also the lead author of an upcoming encyclopedia chapter entitled Feminist Planning and Urbanism, Understanding the Past for an Inclusive Future. So, Jenna, to kick off our dialogue, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how your work in urban planning relates to aspects of urban resilience?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here. So I'm currently in Calgary, Canada, which, if people don't know, it's about an hour from Banff. So you may have seen lovely mountainous snowy photos of it before. Though I've lived around the world, this is where I have called home the longest. And importantly, Calgary is located within the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. After working in planning for about 4 or 5 years, I further realized how important working across sectors and disciplines was, which led me to complete a master's program in community development, which itself was about 90% women enrolled. And a key element of urban resilience to me is avoiding working inside silos. So working across sectors and across disciplines and enabling efficiencies and innovation through partnerships. So for me, having finished my master's in community development while working full-time in urban planning, I signed up for the Urban Resilience Summer School and I'm now thankful to be part of this urban resilience community of practice. And I found it really valuable to learn from other experiences from across the globe.
Thank you. We also know that you're an avid urban cyclist in Calgary. What does a feminist urban planner experience when she cycles around the city?
Well, lots of things. I would say I didn't really bike as a method of transportation until I was doing my undergrad in Montreal. And I should say also, I do call myself a female cyclist, but a lot of women who bike do not like the term cyclist because they associate it with wearing spandex. So the term itself can be a little contentious, but overall there tends to be more aggression towards you on the road. I mean, I've been hit by cars while biking. I've been kind of pushed into snow banks. I've been honked at, I've been yelled at, but I think women generally have more concerns with safety. Obviously I'm stereotyping a little bit, but typically women are more comfortable biking in areas with protected cycle tracks, as has been in the case in Calgary, where we got a cycle track system and the percentage of women biking went up about 20 to 30% in a couple of years. Ultimately, I find as a woman cycling, you're more thoughtful about the route you're taking. So whether which paths to take at night, whether they have good lighting, have clear view lines, And I think it's the same with women walking or biking. They tend to plan their routes more, and it's also an element of time of day and also season. So in Calgary, winter biking is exceptionally more difficult on certain routes because despite what they're actually supposed to do, snow is usually piled in painted bike lanes, which makes your interaction with vehicles far more common. Interestingly, women's cycling was very much tied to the suffragette movement. So there was a strong attempt to make women stop cycling by marketing things like they would get permanent bike face or resting bike face, as I like to call it, if they bike too much. And women pushed back and they even designed specific clothing to be more adaptable to being on a bike, like dresses or skirts that could kind of turn into pants so that they could bike. I've also find an element of urban biking is women and parents that are starting to bike with more kids or cargo bikes. So at least in my city of Calgary, bike infrastructure doesn't really accommodate these types of bikes. And bike paths are routinely designed with metal bollards in the middle, making it really difficult to navigate. And I know multiple women who have continued to bike while pregnant, who have still received a lot of aggression from drivers on the road.
And I think that's really, that's so interesting, because I think in a way, you know, like in the 1850s, you had the concepts of like strolling around the city and the flaneur. And I think it's really interesting, like just to kind of remark what a male gaze that was, like to feel safe to kind of go out for a walk and just enjoy the city versus the sort of the types of aggressions, but also just the physical barriers that I think different people encounter when trying to navigate the city. So yeah, it's really interesting. And I think it's interesting to hear about your experience kind of cycling around the city that you work in, but also the city that you, where your work is also in the context of urban planning. So it feels quite meta to me. And I guess to frame the next topic, I wanted to bring up a quote from your upcoming book chapter that really struck me, that in there, you say that feminist urbanism has been generally described to explore how the built environment excludes the consideration of gender. It acknowledges that cities and city building practices have been created and evolved through predominantly patriarchal structures that have reinforced sexism in both public and private context. So, to begin with, can you expand on this a bit more? What are the consequences of this today? And you were touching on some of them already, but what is really at stake as we look forward towards addressing urban challenges?
Yeah, so good question. Not a small question. but I think due to planning and city building professions being mostly male dominated, especially at leadership and management levels, this has been routinely reflected in the built form. So yes, things are improving and we are having conversations more about equity and what gender inclusivity and gender mainstreaming is, or what that would look like in a city. But ultimately, it is still mostly women that are pushing for these efforts, which is difficult when women are mostly not in the positions of power and decision making. But to boil it down to basics, planners, planning theorists, and academics, and all urbanist-related professionals have been and still are predominantly white cis males. And as they have been surrounded by those similar to them, the standard design of cities has been solely for them at the expense of everyone else. So a recent example I can think of in my current city was last week, actually, where there was an article that came out that there was a man that was sexually harassing women that hadn't been caught yet, but it had occurred multiple times. So they were trying to warn women there was an article published where they gave like top tips for women. so it included things like don't walk at night, only walk in places with good lighting, do not hold anything, do not get distracted, don't rummage in your bag, and don't, and kind of like look straightforward type of things. But to me, I guess this kind of highlighted my slight feminist rage because ultimately, we're still saying like women need to act like robots to accommodate an environment that isn't made for them, versus we need to design cities that enables the safe movement and mobility of everyone. And I'm not talking about just white women like myself. I'm talking about in intersectional feminism, right? So everyone, racialized women, people with mobility challenges, everyone like that. I think the emphasis has been on making women improve or change their actions versus actually making changes in the built environment, if that makes sense. So I think if we continue to address urban challenges without considering gender and intersectionality, then we are continuing to ignore half the population. And really, to me, that is not truly harnessing the potential for sustainable solutions in the long term.
And I think I'd really like us to unpack that a bit more, because you and your co-authors define feminist urbanism in a way as something that's missing, as an absence or as an exclusion. And maybe I would like to ask you the reverse question. So what does feminist urbanism that seeks to remediate this exclusion look like? So what is different when we put these considerations at the heart of urban planning? And specifically, what is different when we, in the context of efforts to accelerate urban adaptation and to build our resilience to the increasing effects of climate change?
Yeah, so I think ultimately communities and cities that are built and designed to the betterment of all through an intersectional feminist lens, and communities that are designed with people in mind rather with development and cost at the center, should be the priority. So to me, feminist urbanism means working with communities as opposed to for communities. In anthropology, they use the terms emic and etic. So emic is working within a community and with the people, and etic is basically just observing people from the outside and making assumptions. So what was typically associated with armchair anthropology. If we're talking about climate change, and adaptation, feminism is, and specifically ecofeminism, is very much intertwined with the environment. So in its most basic sense, women have been more associated with caregiving and care roles, which is tied to preservation of ecosystems. So it has been shown over and over that women are more impacted by disasters across the world. And when disasters occur, women are typically the ones at home caring for families or others. And because of this, they aren't typically involved in rebuilding efforts after disaster. There's a great example of this in the book Invisible Women, which if you haven't read, I would really recommend, where they rebuilt homes in a village in India after a disaster. But as they didn't involve or talk to women, none of the homes, and I think there were about over 200 of them, had kitchens in them. So to me, it's glaringly obvious that, I mean, you can't just consider these elements after a disaster. There needs to be systems in place. So it's a systemic element to consider gender.
Speaking of climate change and also the increasing intensity of shocks and stressors, I'm thinking of the pandemic, right? Hard not to. And during the pandemic, we've seen the concept of the 15-minute cities gain traction as our values in many European and North American cities have shifted. So from focusing on cities as spaces of consumption and work, we've started to appreciate more blue and green spaces, play spaces, social spaces, where we are not consumers or workers, but residents above all. But what I wanted to bring here is that the concept is not that new. It was already floated in the early 90s, like 30 years ago. When Vienna in Austria explored the concept of the city of short distance. And the city came up with this concept as a solution to a gender-sensitive planning. So what I would like to ask you first is, what is the potential of such a concept for feminist resilient urbanism? but also how might we address issues such as green gentrification or further exclusion and marginalization that are linked to this approach. From LA to Barcelona, there is this worrying trend that has been observed as neighborhoods that implement climate action. It comes at a price of some inhabitants that are excluded from the benefits. I would like to know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think for me, I have a bit of an issue with the 15-minute city concept, because at least to me, it fundamentally should be talking about people-centered complete communities. But as you mentioned, reducing something to a time frame alludes to efficiency and speed rather than ambling through a community and enjoying its different spaces at different paces. As you said, Vienna has always been a strong example of gender mainstreaming, but obviously it's not perfect in itself. There's a lot of critique of, I mean, if you're naming streets after women, that's great, but what are actually the long-term impacts of those decisions? But recently I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about how in Vienna, the mix of affordable housing in each community is very important. And I think something that stood out to me as being a very feminist approach was that in a new affordable housing development, they actually met with each prospective tenant to ask how they wanted their unit to be designed. So to me, that's a really great approach because you're not assuming that the token design will function for everyone. And I would say there's, as I said, there's not a perfect system, and obviously cities are having, find it difficult to have that feminist lens in policy and in zoning mechanisms. But I think making those changes are difficult, but we have to think about what are, should the short-term and long-term policy implications be? And what process mechanisms do we need to ensure diversity of housing and affordability, but also having maintenance of local businesses, amenities at varying price points, access to green spaces, and active transportation modes. Actually, I was just thinking, funnily enough, one of the first conversations I had in my community development master's, there was a lot of people in the nonprofit fields, and me coming as the token urban planner, they immediately said but what about gentrification? And I was very kind of standoffish because being kind of still relatively new in my career, I was very defensive of the profession. But I think, yeah, green gentrification is obviously an issue, but I think because sometimes it's done without thinking of the comprehensive systems change. So if this project is effective, or what needs to change in order for other projects like it to happen. And I think ultimately a part of that, which kind of connects to what I talked to before, is the partnerships and the communication between different stakeholders at the community level. So you're not just implementing a really great blue-green infrastructure project that then creates that discrepancy or moves people out of communities.
Definitely. And I think it's so important. And, you know, we come back to this theme over and over again, but I think it's really important to really pay attention to those questions of the resilience to what and whose resilience. And I think they're such, in a way, they're such simple questions, but in many ways, they can really help shine a light on the unintended consequences that might come out of the, you know, of the best intentions, actually. And actually, how do we map out these secondary consequences as well? But your comment there about the urban planning profession is a perfect segue onto our next question. So, you know, we've explored a bit about your background as a planner. We've explored some of the key issues that we need to take into consideration. And in this last part of our conversation, we'd like to delve a bit deeper into what might this all mean for your profession, your discipline of urban planning. And we're curious, what are you witnessing as an urban planner, as a policy researcher as well? What are your thoughts on how things are changing across the research and practice of the discipline? I'm really curious, what is the potential for change? And maybe what are the positive signals that you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because it's very important to focus on what positive change is happening. It's great to critique things, but we need to move in a better direction. So I would say I see some change, but it's perhaps still not identified as feminist or equitable. And I would say, especially at the local government level, there seems to be a lot of hesitancy with integration and implementation of these concepts. So kind of like, well, we don't really know what a gender inclusive city looks like, so we're not gonna try and actually make it happen. But ultimately, having an intersectional feminist lens for urban planning means acknowledging the mistakes that have been made in the past with things like redlining and very exclusionary engagement processes, and continuously striving to do better. And when we were writing the chapter, myself and my co-authors, it became clear that most of the work that is being done is by grassroots organizations, because there seems to be difficulty enforcing timely changes at other levels of governments or organizations. But I think there's some key projects that come to mind that aren't necessarily identified as feminist, but to me are feminist. So Montreal recently announced like a key climate focus of their budget, and they're doing participatory budgeting, which to me is quite a feminist thing. You're involving the community in the budget of like the municipal services. A good example also from during the pandemic is Hawaii, that adopted a feminist economic recovery plan. So that's at the federal level, and kind of connects to all the other levels of government. And I believe that it's mandatory for all the organizations to follow it. And then I guess more at the global scale, there are organizations like UN Women, there's a foreign feminist policy network as well. But I think there's difficulty moving from like that level down to the local government level. And I think a good example of that is the Sustainable Development Goals. So Goal 5 strives to achieve gender equality for all women. But because there's no requirement that I'm aware of for that to be included in any kind of like policy document, at least in Canada, for like the federal, provincial, or municipal levels, then how do we know if there are projects or policies that are happening that align with it? How are we monitoring that? How are we sharing best practices? I think there's definitely a gap there. In the Canadian context, there is a gender-based analysis plus tool that was created by the federal government originally in the late 90s, but there is no requirement for implementing it. So for instance, myself and a couple of colleagues did the kind of basic training and we got the lovely certificate, but then when we tried to implement it into a policy project, there was kind of that gap between understanding the importance of it and actually that kind of buy-in by leadership of how to incorporate it into the process.
Building on that need for change, what might this mean more broadly, like in terms of education, in terms of professional bodies, but also employers, municipalities, as you were talking about? What needs to change and how might the alternative look like? And I also would like to ask you, what's your role in that? Or what role do you want to play in that?
I would like to be the leader. but yeah, I think to start, I would also like to quote a quote from the feminist chapter from a book about women in planning in Canada. So the profession of planning and its conventional history has been limited to a few male planning visionaries. Women's efforts were not recognized as legitimate planning, and due to the narrative of professionalization, many scholars have acknowledged that community building movements outside of token city building have played an equally important role. So noting that I was educated and most of my work experience has been in Canada, the only women planner that I really learned about in my undergraduate education was Jane Jacobs, and she wasn't even a planner. I can see that things have improved since then. I mean, I'm not that old, but that was about 10 or 15 years ago now. And I have seen kind of equity and design diversity groups popping up that are student-led, that are amazing, kind of different resources available. But then I still see panels and events that have only male architects, planners, or engineers. And if there is a woman present, she's the moderator. So I think to me, there needs to be far more education of women's involvement in cities, even if they have not considered or were not considered to be valid professionals. So we are educated about Le Corbusier, who I just read was apparently a feminist, didn't know that, but not on Sri Lanka's first modernist architect, Minette da Silva. So it seems as though there are more women academics, but that doesn't mean that they are published as much as their male counterparts or their research is funded. A really good book about this is called Data Feminism that I would recommend, and it's available free online. And in terms of professional organizations, the Rural Town Planning Institute has released reports in the last couple of years on women in planning. And they had a Women in Planning conference in 2019, I believe. And the Canadian Institute of Planners has released a brief report on equity and diversity, but these aren't really acknowledged or incorporated at the local government level or in urbanist related workplaces. So the actual action or change behind them isn't really happening, at least right now. But I think for me, it can't just be about having more women in the room and in the conversations and where decisions are being made, because the structures need to change to acknowledge the importance of women being in those positions. And whether that's entry-level planners or academics or women in leadership positions. And furthermore, we need to support, involve, and advocate for racialized women, because this isn't just about having more white women planners and city builders, because planning is a very white profession. And I think that's become even more obvious after all the killings in the US and the anti-racism marches. And furthermore, men need to push for these changes, because it can't just be about the women pushing for change, because they're not in the rooms where decisions are being made. And in many countries, female planners may not feel comfortable speaking up. And that's been my experience volunteering for the Commonwealth Women in Planning Network, which in itself, the Commonwealth is a very colonial, racialized thing. But a lot of the women in different countries where planning is kind of a young discipline felt uncomfortable even volunteering, just because they didn't want it to affect their professional advancement and how they were viewed. And I think we have to remember that too. It can't always be the women that are experiencing those things to help create the change, because I mean, I just read a report from the Globe and Mail in Canada saying that there's all these kind of policies about equitable workplaces, but they're actually finding that companies can get around them. So women who speak up are then fired under kind of different terms. So they don't say, oh, it's because you had two kids and went on mat leave. It was just the person we hired after was so much better than you. so I think those things have to change as well. It's not just about one policy. It's about all these things have to shift to make cities more equitable.
And I think this kind of brings to mind a quote by Audre Lorde, who said that for the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. And I think some of the things that we explored today are actually around the fact that we need new ways of relating to each other, new ways of appreciating what different people bring to the challenges that we're facing, and really kind of thinking about how do we value different worldviews, different belief systems, and also like how do we kind of tackle some really difficult issues that have very different outcomes for different people. So I guess there's a lot, and obviously we can't do a summary to kind of do justice to all the different insights that you brought. But it's been really interesting to almost to shine a light on some of these aspects, and also to hear some of the stories from a Canadian perspective as well, while acknowledging that, you know, these experiences will be very, very different in different corners of this globe. But yeah, lovely to have you with us.
That was really instructive, and I really hope that this piece of conversation will help to shed the lights on the role of feminism into building more resilient cities. And I believe in your leadership skills. Thank you very much for your time, for sharing all this with us. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me. And thanks, Karina, for pointing out. Yeah, I do acknowledge that my perspective comes from very much like a point of privilege, and these different priorities will be very different depending on their context. But I've really appreciated having all these conversations. And when we were writing the chapter, we also got input from, I think, over 25 women from across the world on all these efforts that are occurring that aren't even acknowledged in publication or on a website. So I think it's really important to have that diversity of perspectives.
To be continued. Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com, or you can tweet us
with the hashtag #UREDialogues. Chat to you soon.